Okay, this is our final hour with Linda Moulton Howe, and we're going to take your phone calls, your stories, conversations with Linda next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us, and we'll get to your calls in just a moment. Linda, what else are you working on these days?
Well, I have been doing a lot of research on Ceres, on the Bright Crater, and working on trying to understand more about the 3 mile, they call it a mountain, sort of pyramid shape now.
Oh, strange story, yeah.
And I'm doing Earth Files News videos at YouTube. I have a channel, and I have done 3 Earth Files, and 2 of them have been about Ceres with 2 different interviews with people in the Dawn and in the Ceres missions. And upcoming, the next big threshold is going to be the end of August. They should be getting down to 932 miles above the surface. And in the first week of September, once they get back into that orbit, I think it's going to be called Orbit 3, then they should be taking a whole lot of photos at 932 miles. This last was 2,700 miles, so that's quite a drop down. And there are so many questions. We still haven't seen any photographs or efforts to photograph from the Dawn spacecraft as the Ceres turns and rotates. If this were something artificial, then it would be bright in the shadow side of Ceres as well. And the only thing we have seen so far have been photographs only on the front side, and most people think that it is remaining bright as it goes into the shadow, but we haven't seen anything that's been from the shadow side. And there's another very interesting mystery that a lot of people haven't talked much about, and I put in the Earth Files News YouTube, and that is that they have infrared, and in the infrared, in contrast, you might say that whatever was happening, even if it was an extrusion of something coming from below, that there might be a temperature change in that crater. And right now, on the infrared studies they have done, they have found areas that were colder on Ceres, and the temperature there is down at, I think it's a minus 160 degrees Fahrenheit, and that the area where the crater is doesn't show any variation at all from the surrounding environment around the crater, which is another very interesting mystery.
You had mentioned the crater. Did you see the Pluto pictures? Again, like Ceres, lights that are popping up on Pluto, too.
Differently, though, I think, because Pluto is, from at least as far as I know, is a gaseous planet. Mm-hmm. And Ceres is a dwarf planet. It's in the asteroid belt area. And it is the only body there that was large enough to become a sphere. It's round. All the other asteroids in the asteroid belt are very jagged or irregular in shape. So this dwarf planet, and a planet definition is round. That's one of the characteristics. But this is small, 600 miles in diameter. And you think about that, George. It's 600 miles in diameter. It's a dwarf planet. It's got a crater that has had brightness in it since the Hubble telescope took a photo in 2004. And that, even though it was blurry because they didn't have high enough resolution, it still was the same place on Ceres where this bright spot was a decade ago. And now it's there, and with all these details of two triangular patterns, and you have to ask the question, what in the world would be sustaining 40 times the brightness of the background for at least a decade? And we don't know how long it was going before, because 2004 was the first time Hubble got the photo. So now we're at 2015, and that same area is so bright, there are these, I think, triangular patterns that look very calculated. Is that a fair word?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Deliberate.
And then you have the 3-mile-high, quote-unquote, mountain on a 600-mile diameter planet, and you're standing, or at least what goes through my mind is, well, what are the forces that would be in this little planet that would have produced any of this phenomena? And then on top of everything, scientists think that under the surface of this little dwarf planet Ceres with all these mysteries, there could actually be a layer of liquid water.
Wow.
On Ceres. So now I on coast, when we get into September, that 932 miles, we should have all those new photos that first week. And I really would like to report everything I can possibly learn. And if we don't know what it is by 932 miles, there's one more chance, December, 235 miles above the surface. That's lower than, it would be down lower if we were on Earth and you went up to the ISS. The International Space Station is higher than 235 miles, so this would be even lower than that. And here is another strange issue, that according to Professor Russell, who is the principal investigator on the Ceres mission, they didn't have enough money for a really fine resolution camera on Dawn, and that by the time, even at 235 miles, he said that each pixel would be 40 to 45, I think it's 40 miles by 40 miles, and that might not be a fine enough resolution to accurately and detailed see what's in that crater. And it's either a comment on what we're trying to do, a space research with not enough money, or I don't know what, that we wouldn't go with a really fine camera.
That's amazing. And have you seen the Curiosity rover on Mars, the picture it took of a pyramid there?
That is so interesting to me.
Wow.
Well, first of all, it's small. People think of pyramids as being large, but there are markers on our planet that are pyramidal shape. But the estimate is that it may be about the size of a small car, meaning maybe 10 feet, 12 feet, somewhere in there. And some of the criticism has been, well, we're looking at only one angle, and it's in a field of all of those angular rocks. But when you just kind of look at that photo, it jumps out as being, you can fill in, let's put it that way, you can fill in the pyramid sides because the front two seem so accurate. And if it turns out that this is a small piece of a pyramid, or it's buried underneath or something like that, then all of the ancient history about the link between Mars and Earth and Mesopotamia may actually be being written large in front of us.
All right, to the phones now we go with Linda. Let's start with Bill in Wilmington, Delaware. Welcome to the Pro Show, Bill. You are on the air. If I can get my computer working, there you go. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, George and Linda. Linda, I recently saw photos on your website of a crop circle in Tennessee.
Right.
And in Delaware, a week or two ago, we had two of them pop up. Well, two different towns, Bridgeville, Delaware in Sussex County, and then Dover, Delaware in Kent County, right next to Dover Air Force Base. Shocker, surprise, surprise, multiple crop circles in both of those towns and wheat fields. I thought we might get some aerial photos last week. We had Paul McCartney headline our music festival, but I haven't seen anything in the press or anything. I don't have any access to any GoPros or helicopters or anything, but
well, I have not heard anything about this. I usually get people all over North America are always sending me things in their local media, but I haven't heard anything about these crop patterns you're talking about?
Well, the one I spotted on the MUFON site a couple weeks ago, which is Bridgeville, Delaware, and that was on the MUFON site. There was also a MUFON thing about Dover, Delaware, a nationally televised NASCAR race about a month ago with a UFO that was photographed by both a national TV camera and a local one. But the other crop circles in Dover, Delaware, by the airbase, I have not heard anything about that so far. But I was wondering if MUFON was looking after it or anything.
What date was that reported? Did we lose him? Hello?
Hello, Bill.
I'm coming in and out. What was the question?
What date was that reported, the one in Dover?
That one was just about a week ago. The one in Bridgeville was closer to 3-4 weeks ago that it popped up. Somebody put it on the MUFON site.
Well, could you get whatever media has been done on Dover, if anything, or even surface land photos, and send whatever you have about it to me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. I'd really like to see it. Turns out, it appears that the gray Tennessee pattern, it was in hay grass about 3 feet high, and it appears that a college student organized it.
Linda, about how many tips do you get from calls like this when we do your conversations with Linda?
Oh, a lot. I get a lot of email after, and it's extremely valuable, and I get lots of leads, and this is just so important to have this dialogue with the audience and let people know that at earthfiles.com, my website, that I am doing in-depth reports throughout the entire month, and I'm also doing Earth Files news videos for YouTube. And then there's Coast Radio and other radio, and all of it just is constant. It never stops. So these from tonight, hopefully there will be some solid leads and learning about Dover, for example, a week ago. If I haven't heard anything locally, tonight will be the first time, and I'm sure looking forward to seeing what is there and what kind of crop. And there has been a... I'm going to say there's been a strange season in England, but I have seen some very, very interesting patterns in Italy, in Spain. The one in Russia I thought was really interesting. And so this may be a summer where it is a more international phenomena, and maybe we will have more patterns in the United States and Canada.
Let's go to Luke in Wyoming, west of the Rockies. Luke, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
George, how you doing?
Good. Everybody's fine.
Hey, thanks for having me on here. Linda, kind of a switch up on you. Sorry, I don't have any leads for you as far as crop circles or anything goes like that. But back when I was 18, I had a spiritual experience. I don't know exactly what it was or what had happened, but a friend of mine, me and my friend, his girlfriend was in jail and mine was gone at the time. We were discussing love and the topic of, like, you know, beauty and how we saw love and what beauty is. And, you know, we spoke of this, of what we thought it were and how we felt like love was something that was hidden from us. Well, the more the evening went on, we just approached through different events in each other's lives, how they kind of like coincided with each other in timeline. And when we looked at each other towards the end of the conversation, it was this epiphany that we had. And I can't explain it. It's strange, and I try to talk to people about it around me, and nobody understands, but maybe you do. I looked at him, and he looked at me, and we both at the same time just said, "You're God, and I'm God, and our choices that we make are what lead us forward in life, and based on material that we take in, we put out." And I don't know what that meant. And the more and more research I did on this, with my star sign, I'm a Taurus, I always was led to the Pleiades cluster and what that is, and, you know, it's very confusing, and it's just led me down this really strange path in my life. I don't know, maybe you could touch up on that a little bit if you've had any experience with these type of things.
Well, the context that I could give, which I think is fundamentally true, goes to the Bell's theorem in physics that every photon in the universe is connected in some way, and that matrix that is light and physics and at the quantum level, where entanglement also could mean that one end of the universe could literally be communicating to the other end of the universe through entanglement, and that it would bypass, it would supersede sound and even light. And that what when people get this impression that they are the universe or they are part of the divine, I think that it's kind of a gestalt in this universe that if we really get to a point where we understand what is underneath the surface of the environment around us, and we are like that woodcut in Europe where the child is lifting up the outside of the, or lifting up the tent and is looking outside, and here there are stars and suns and an entire universe beyond this closed place that he was in, that is the situation that humans find themselves repeatedly challenged with, and that we are at such a, I think, revolutionary time, because if we survive ourselves, it seems to me that finally just getting, and part of what you just described, I think, relates to this, that we're not alone in this universe, that we are connected to this universe, and that even if we are standing up primates in which DNA was manipulated by extraterrestrial biological entities to create us, which that's been in government documents, there is something tremendously liberating and exciting about the idea that in this century, in spite of all the problems, that we could live to see that big headline, we're not alone in this universe. And once that occurs, we all have permission to then discuss exactly the question you are raising, to discuss lights that we see, craft that we see, entities that we see, instead of it being mythological or subject to sarcasm. It's as if the tent will be lifted. And the whole planet will be able, I hope, to really have dialogues about what happens at the moment of death for real. Is reincarnation the machinery of this cosmos, because there is a fabric of the divine that ties it all together from beginning to end, and that at the moment of death, it isn't annihilation, it is some sort of resurrection of the energy that was the soul spirit. And if we all were talking on those levels all of the time, I just can't believe that there could be so much war and violence.
It's a hateful planet, Linda, to be sure. Stick around. We're going to come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take some final phone calls with Linda. Conversations with Linda when we come right back. Well, David Schrader manning the command post while I tape that pilot tomorrow night. So make sure you're part of the program. He's got some great things ahead for you. And welcome back. Our special guest, Linda Moulton Howe, with us. Linda, you'll be with us next month for sure again, too, right?
Yes.
Great, great. No conflicts there. And then can you believe it? A few more months, you and I will be talking about your Thanksgiving and Christmas schedule. Jeez.
It's hard to believe, isn't it? It's like we're on a spinning merry-go-round that goes faster and faster.
You've got to do a segment for us on why it appears that time is just going by so fast.
Yeah, you know, that would be a very good question for George Ellis. I'm going to ask.
Yeah, I would love to find out. I mean, everyone has that perception.
Yeah.
No matter where you go, everybody says, this is the fastest year we've ever had.
I know,
it's just, we got to slow this down. When you first started doing your stories, what percent of the stories consisted of mutilations and crop formations when you just started doing this?
Well, you'd have to go back to, let's see, Art Bell and I started in 1992, and that was a time when crop formations were the most exciting phenomena on the planet, because there was none of the Team Satan crop circle contests and all of the muddying of the waters that kicked in around 1995. So those, that I would say 1989 to 1994, it was a time of great excitement of the crop formations and questions even then, because presented to me in a crop formation by a man from the United States when I was in England in 1993, he said that he knew somebody working for the Central Intelligence Agency and that they were using Cray computers and satellites and trying to photograph and track every single crop formation that was happening on the planet in both hemispheres. And their goal was to see if there was a mathematical language embedded in the patterns and the relationship on the magnetic field grid of the Earth. And then he said, the first time this was ever introduced to me was there in that crop formation in 1993. He said, the hypothesis is that we're dealing with time travelers and that the crop formations are their test markers about how accurate they are in whatever part of time they are trying to get into.
All right, let's go to the phones again for Linda. Mike is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, east of the Rockies. Michael, go ahead.
I'd like to say I don't think the past is any more completely fixed than the future. And two recent examples came across my TV screen, in not just Brian Williams, but NBC's series Aquarius, and the History Channel's program called The Cannibal in the Jungle.
And you are saying that they were demonstrating for you that the past could be changed.
They completely rewrote history.
A television show can be interpretive in fiction in any way, and it still doesn't have any impact on the past.
I'm amazed at some of these programs, Linda, like the Lone Gunman, where they literally had the blueprint for 9/11 before it happened, planes crashing into buildings. And so many TV shows seem to have these events before they occur. It's weird.
And, George, though, this is the issue of Einstein again. If he was correct and time is an illusion and that the alpha to the omega is already written, the conversation we're having right now at this moment has already been there and all over the planet and everywhere, it would mean that we matter entities are simply moving through the three-dimensional matter and fourth-dimensional time matrix, and everything is locked in, and sometimes life does feel that way, as if there are continual moments that you seem to catch up with, and they seem destined and fated. And how could there be precognition and all of that if there wasn't something coming from the future and interacting with the present that gives information? But I also can jump over to George Ellis's point of view and say, if it were true in the cosmos that it is locked in, then we don't, as conscious individuals, have free will. But it would mean that something as horrible as Hitler and the Holocaust would already have been written in the alpha to the omega, and everybody, we reject that. And it seems cleaner if the future is blank and has this quantum collapse mechanism that nobody knows how it works. Nobody has anything outside of mathematical theories about it. And it would mean that right now, you, I, 7.2 billion and growing on the planet and all the animals and everything that have consciousness, that as each moment rubs up against the future, leaving the past, it's just this very tiny, narrow thing that we call the present. And that if it's constantly blank, how could there be precognition?
How could?
The, that's the gigantic challenge in even trying to understand time, past, present, and future. And Einstein thought in his special theory of relativity that space-time, as soon as time is a fourth dimension, and with relativity having to do with depending upon your velocity and your position in the universe, past, present, and future, you don't see that they are all the same, that premise. It either means that humans have not lived long enough to have a perspective on how the universe really works, or there is something else at work that we don't comprehend.
Well, I heard you when you were talking to George, the incredible times that you escape death because of this ability. And that's happened to me too.
Yeah, and more than once in my life. And I know other people the same. And how can it be when, in my case, that semi-truck that I didn't know was there, I was going up to Aspen area from Denver, and it was where I'm on a climb, and there was a big huge bend in the road. So where I'm coming, I can't see anything beyond the bend, and you know how that works in the mountains. And yet, it was so strong that I pulled the car over and stopped, even questioning myself, what am I doing? But in sitting there and obeying something that was, well, that's the issue. Is it seeing from another dimensional perspective what is happening, sort of the way when we look down on ants scurrying around on a sidewalk? The only relationship that ants may have to humans and animals is vibration and changes in light and shadow.
And they're smarter.
That's possible. And what is it that comes into our lives from the future and many times saves our lives?
When I was a little kid, little being about 12 to 14, I loved watching ants. I had one of those ant farms at home, Linda, and one of the things I used to do when I would find a ant hill outside is I knocked it down because I wanted to see how long it would take them to rebuild it. And they would build it back within a day.
Right.
It was unbelievable what they would do. They'd all go scurrying around, running all over the place. But there must have been some kind of order in there. But I've always wondered if there was that one ant who barked out the orders, because they just all seem to work together.
No, that's the hive mind. The mind is in all of the units. So here we come from a human perspective, and where every human is like an island separated from all other humans, and we don't understand each other very well. The ants, the bees, the hive, they will operate as a unit, that everything is going to a frequency, is reacting to cycles, it's all at one. And perhaps in the universe, if we knew the truth, that there really is a question about which is better in the long run, to be in a organic or even artificial intelligence unit that operates as a hive because it expands the ability of the mind and the potential, or to operate as the island individual because that's where greater creativity comes, perhaps. And those two are sort of butted up against each other.
All right, back to the calls we go. Bill is in Fort Worth, Texas. Bill, you're on with Linda Moulton Howe. Go ahead, Bill.
Greetings, Linda.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, I just wanted to hit a couple of things real fast. I know the show's about to end. First, I've had interaction since childhood with these small beings, and that's not why I called, because that's a long story. They've taught me a few things. One thing, astral projection, and being able to do that, I know in my heart, as you said earlier about time. You know, we are in time, but there is actually an outside of time. So I agree with you. Also, I wanted to mention something that's happened. Well, it's happened a lot that I've noticed, and I just want your opinion on it. In my neighborhood, you know, I was with a friend just out going to the convenience store, and he was a Vietnam vet, and of course we'd had a lot of talks about UFOs and things like that since they're kind of a big part of my life. And, you know, he always kind of joked and, you know, never really believed me, even after all he's experienced, and that's a lot. But we were coming down a road just maybe 3 blocks from the house, and I look over to my right, and behind a tree I see this really bright light that shouldn't have been there, you know, and I just knew it shouldn't have been there. So I whipped my vehicle around, and as quickly as I could turn the vehicle around, this thing lifted up in front of both of us, probably less than 200 yards, lifted up, went straight up into the sky at super speed, and then it shot across the sky, like across the freeway out here off of 35. It went straight across it and just disappeared, I mean, in a flash. Mm-hmm. And then one other time, I woke up, looked out the window, and saw one of those black triangles just flying really low over the neighborhood. And, you know, I know I've had interactions. I know I've been changed. And I'm just curious, do you think that what I caught was something, you know, possibly going on? It knew that I saw it. It reacted, I mean, immediately. Well,
my question to you is, what is the most valuable piece of information you have received?
There's so much. I couldn't...
Well, just one. What is the most valuable?
I would say if anyone has read The 12th Planet, that's a really short book.
Zechariah Sitchin.
Yeah, it has a lot of answers in it. But mainly that our civilization, you know, developed in the Mesopotamia Valley, and with some help. They say, you know, even Zechariah pointed out that all the grains that started appearing on the scene came from Mesopotamia. Everything that we have in our society, our modern society today, came from Mesopotamia. If you look back through the history, the grains just started appearing, you know, the grasses, and then, you know, the fruits and the trees, and even in the Bible it lists how the grains and then the trees and everything in that order came about. And Zechariah said it was almost as if it was a genetic biological laboratory there.
Exactly, and I have talked with him many times. God bless him, we're at whatever dimension he is in right now, but if he were on this phone call, I'm sure that he would say that it is so obvious that 5,000 years ago there were technologies that were constructing pyramids and ziggurats and moving all kinds of material around this planet.
All right, Linda, my dear, I'll see you in about a month, okay?
Yes, there is so much going on, and I look forward to it, and thank you.
You got it. Linda Bolton Howe, website, earthfiles.com, and you can always email her at earthfiles@earthfiles.com, and you can always email us, george@coasttocoastam.com. Don't forget Dave Schrader filling in for me tomorrow. We're going to be wrapping up this pilot program, then we'll see what happens. I'll tell you more about that in the not-too-distant future. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Timothy Banal, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.